Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark LeBounier. Drama coming up in this hour with two interesting stories. Later on, the No Plays of Japan from the CBS Radio Workshop. But first, it's This Is My Best with Orson Welles, starring in an adaptation of Robert Louis Stevenson's The Master of Ballantrae. First heard on CBS on April 10th, 1945.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles, inviting you to listen to Stevenson's Master of Ballantrae on Cresta Blanca's This Is My Best.
This is my best. America's greatest stars in the world's best stories. Presented each week by Shenley's Cresta Blanca wine. Wine of friendly nature. Pride of the vintner's art. Symbol of hospitality. Compliment to honored guests. A wine to serve proudly, saying, "This is my best. This is Cresta Blanca." C-R-E-S-T-A? B-L-A-N-C-A. Cresta Blanca. Cresta Blanca. Now, here is our producer, Mr. Orson Welles.
Well, we have a great cast tonight on This Is My Best, a real Mercury cast. Agnes Moorhead, Ray Collins, and Alan Napier, who, with your obedient servant, will bring you now The Master of Ballantrae. The scene is Scotland, a strange part of it, a place of barren moors, within earshot of the thunderous surf that beats savagely in all weather on the rocky Solway shore.
Qua duri induris dir, ain't to tie and ain't to ride, an ill day for the groom and a war day for the bride.
An ill day for the groom and a war day for the bride. I was the bride of my Lord of Durrisdeer. I, Alison Graham, and it fell to me to play a part in the fulfillment of that bitter prophecy. At the start of the war, on that fateful winter's night in the year 1745, the old laird, Mr. Henry, myself and Jamie, the handsome young master of Ballantrae, were gathered in the great hall to decide a matter of grave import.
I will have none of it, I tell you, I will have none of it.
Harder.
Twill do Scotland no manner of good if the last sons of a line go off to war. Mayhap to thee in battle, and leave no heirs to carry on the name of Durrisdeer.
Let Henry bide at home, then.
Nay, Parrot, we dinna listen to him. He's no Durrisdeer, we fine continental manner.
I am the direct heir of Durrisdeer.
Well, what say you to this, Mistress Allison?
I don't trust my judgment in this matter, my lord, for I've given my heart to Master Jamie, as you know, and would keep him here if I could.
Put an end to it. Here's a guinea piece. Will you stand by the toss of a coin, Henry?
Aye, I'll stand and power by it. Heads I go, shield I stay.
Shield. Henry will sit by the knitting where he belongs.
If you were not my elder brother and Miss Allison not present...
Henry!
Aye, Father.
'Tis a pity you're so anxious to be off to the wars, Jamie.
I confess 'twill be a relief to get free of this dismal moor for a time.
There is nothing here that would make you want to stay?
Only you, my precious. But you'll keep.
And so it was Jamie rode away to the north, which was the more sorrowful for us to remember when it seemed too late. For the rebellion was a lost cause from the start. And included in the news of the rebels' defeat was the news of the death of my intended husband, the Master of Ballantrae. As soon as the old lord received the news, he called Mr. Henry to his side.
Henry, I still have one son, and I'll do you this justice. It is the kinder of that to you that is left.
Thank you, Father.
Henry, have you no tears to shed for the brother you betrayed?
Betrayed, lass?
He was betrayed by all of us. I, too, sent him off for the harsh words.
Ah, listen. Even in death, he stands between us.
Henry.
Jamie won't ever die. He's still the master of Ballantrae.
He spoke truer than they knew. Some 8 years after that, it happened that Angus MacKellar, the good and faithful steward of our house, while walking along the rocky Solway shore one afternoon, espied a stranger on the edge of Craighead.
Hello! Hello there! Here, my good man. Here are some things for Durisdeer.
Durisdeer? The master said nothing of expecting a visitor from abroad.
Oh, you don't know me, my friend. I know your name and nickname. Come now. We'll miss out on supper at the hall. Mr. Henry will have something besides cold mutton on the board, I trust. Or is he still as stingy as of old?
You, Jamie. I didn't know you with your London speech. You're the master.
Right, MacKellar. The master of Ballantrae.
In the name of heaven, what brings you here? If the king's men learn of it, you'll surely be hanged, Master Jamie. It's the fate of all who fought with the rebels.
I'll warrant my brother would not be sorry to see me hang if it were not for the disgrace it would bring on the family.
Oh, no, no, Master James. Your brother has been more than loyal to you. He has borne the disapproval of his father, the alienation of his wife, all on your account.
It's no secret, I dare say, that if Miss Allison had known I were alive, she'd have never married Henry.
Well, it's not for me to speak, my lord, but this I'm sure of. We can all rely on your discretion.
Oh, have no fear of that, MacKellar. I'll be very discreet.
You shouldn't have come back, Jamie. I wish you hadn't.
Are you like Henry? Do you wish I were truly dead?
Jamie, don't say such things.
How could you have married him? He was never for you.
He loved me, Jamie. I thought he needed me.
He's taken my name, my birthright, my intended wife. But what you feel for me deep down in your heart, he can't take that, can he? Allison, answer me.
No, he can't take that. Heaven help me. I still love you, Jamie. Dark and still and starless and exceeding cold. A night the most unseasonable, fit for strange events. I will leave their description to one who saw them at first hand. A full account is to be found in the private journal of our good steward, MacKellar.
January 27th, 1757. May God have mercy on this house. We have set ourselves to pass the evening with a game of cards. The master of Ballantrae, Mr. Henry and myself. 12 was already gone some time upon the clock, and the servants long ago in bed.
Master Henry, it is yours to play. And that's a very strange thing, how even in a game of cards, you display your rusticity. You play, Jacob, like a bonnet laird or a sailor in a tavern. The same dullness, the same petty greed.
Mr. Henry continued to look at his cards as though very maturely considering some play. But his mind was elsewhere.
You know, my dear Henry, with all those solid qualities which I delight to recognize in you, I never knew a woman who did not prefer me. Nor I think... who did not continue to prefer me.
You coward. Mr. Henry laid down his cards. He rose to his feet very softly and seemed all the while like a person in deep thought. Then, with neither hurry nor any particular violence, he struck the master in the mouth.
A blow. I would not take a blow from God Almighty.
Gentlemen, gentlemen.
You know what this means?
Aye. It is the most deliberate act of my life.
I must have blood. I must have blood for this.
Please, God, it shall be yours. But there are swords on the wall there. Take them down, MacKellar, and see that we play fair. I think it better needful.
A steward here can bring a pair of candles. There is no breath of air.
I took up the candlesticks and went before them, forth from the house. It was as he said. There was no breath stirring. A windless stricture of frost had boned the air, and as we went forth in the light of the candles, the blackness was like a roof over our heads. Ne'er a word was said. There was ne'er a sound but the creaking of our steps along the frozen path.
Here is the place. Set down the candles.
I did as he bid me, and presently the flames went up as steady as in a chamber in the midst of the frosted trees. And I beheld these two brothers take their places.
The light is something in my eyes.
I will give you every advantage, but I think you're about to die.
Henry Dury, if you fall, I shift out of this country to where my money is before me. If I fall, where are you? My father, your wife, who's in love with me, as you very well know, your child who prefers me, how these will avenge me. Had you thought of that, dear Henry?
He looked at his brother with a smile, then made a fence-in-room salute. Never a word, said Mr. Henry, but saluted too, and their swords rang together. I am no judge of the play, but it seems that Mr. Henry took and kept the upper hand from the engagement. It is past doubt the master recognized himself as lost and had some taste of the cold agony of fear, or he had ne'er attempted the foul stroke. He caught his brother's blade with his left hand, a practice not permitted. Mr. Henry only saved himself by leaping on one side. The master lunged, stumbled on his knee, and before he could move, the sword was through his body. He writhed a moment like a trodden worm, and then lay motionless. It was no hour for scruples. I ran back to the house and opened my lady's door without so much as a knock, and I passed boldly in.
There is some calamity happened.
Madam, if you cannot be very helpful, I must go elsewhere. For if no one helps me tonight, there's an end of the house of Doris Dier. It has come to a duel.
In the name of mercy, MacKellar, what's wrong?
You're not fit to hear. Whatever it was, you shall say first it was your fault.
Oh, can you not put me out of your fault?
I think that will say you. I think of none but my poor, dear, unhappy master.
What of my lord?
Go to him now when he sits in the hall. Speak to him. It matters not what you say. Give him your hand and say, I know all. And if God gives you grace enough, say, forgive me.
Oh, God. God strengthen you and make you merciful. I will go to my husband.
I groped my way downstairs and out the door. Outside, I heard the sound of oars, of muffled oars, very guardedly rowing in the bay. I reached the place. My heart thumped upon my ribs. The hair stirred upon my scalp. I listened till my ears ached. The night was hollow about me like an empty church. There was the blood stain, and a little further off, Mr. Henry's sword.
MacKellar!
It's gone.
What?
Why are you here?
It's gone. What's gone?
The master of Ballantrae. The body has disappeared.
It was a cold, sunny morning with a thick white frost when next we heard of the master of Ballantrae. The blackbirds sang exceeding sweet and loud about the house of Doris Vere, and there was a noise of the sea in all the chambers. In the great hall, the shutters were still closed, and in the chimney sat a man in cloak and boots. He did not look up till I was nearly upon him.
So, you, my sweet.
You've dared to come back to this house.
Surprised to see me?
Henry said we'd never see the last of you.
No more will you. I'm home to stay.
What do you want this time?
I'm weary of traveling, lass. Have you no welcome for me in your heart?
All's changed here now, Jamie. Your father is no more. And Henry's Lord Durrisdeer.
I'm still the same, Alison.
No. No, you're not the same, Jamie. You're getting an old man.
If you could see yourself, you'd perhaps not dwell on the topic, my lady. How does the world go with you?
I have undone what I could of the injustice I've done to Henry. He has all my love now.
So now he has that too. And I'll not let him have the better of me, mark my words. This time there'll be no duel with swords. I grow old, as you justly remark, Alison. I play a slower, steadier hand.
Look at him out there.
Henry.
Look at him, poisoning my son's mind against me. It's not enough he's taken over Durrisdeer. He'll have my son as well.
Henry, why do we stay on here in this house at all? Come, let's make up our packet secretly today. The first ship that sails shall bear us to the New World.
Aye, Alison. We'll go to America. But I'll not leave him lord and master here.
Oh, Henry, there is no room in your heart anymore for anything save your hatred for Jamie.
MacKellar shall continue on at the hall. And not one farthing shall be paid to the master of Ballantrae. Do you hear me, Alison? Not one farthing.
Before dawn the next morning, we slipped out of the side postern into a night of darkness, scarce broken by a star or two. And so, at last, we were gone indeed. Having looked our last on the kind roof of Durrisdeer, our faces toward the barbarous country of America.
Good morning, MacKellar. How's old Petticoats? A small breakfast party this morning.
This is the party to which we must grow accustomed, Master Jamie. My lord, my lady, and the children are gone upon a voyage.
Tell me the details of the evasion.
I have no orders to communicate their destination.
But I will tell you, my dear old Petticoats, they have scuttled off to the province of New York, where my lady, it appears, is the heiress of a plantation.
No, now,
I'll follow them, MacKellar, and you'll come with me. I may be poor and penniless, but I'll follow them. And when I've run my quarry down, I'll drive a wedge into that family that shall once more burst it into shivers.
February 23rd, 1763. America. The public disgrace of Jamie's arrival here, all penniless, the rankles in his bones. In a poor quarter of the town, above a wretched hovel, he's hung a placard which reads, James Dury, formerly master of Ballantrae, clothes neatly clouted. And underneath this, when he has a job, my brother-in-law sits busily stitching. The sometime heir of a proud family, set up cross-legged in public, for a reproach upon his brother's meanness.
My good man, have you no finished mending my breeches yet?
Have a heart, Henry. Have a heart. Then take your custom elsewhere. I need it, I'll be frank with you. I have not eaten these 3 days. This is no pose any longer. I really need your custom.
Henry. Henry, this is no manner of behavior to flaunt your hatred thus.
Alison. Alison. So you still have a heart?
Not for you, Jamie. It's Henry I'm thinking of. It's not good for him.
What's not good for me, my dear? Hatred? I grow fat upon it.
And so it was Jamie. It was Jamie this time who packed up and fled. Where to? We had no word. Not for some months. And then...
My lord and lady, I have the painful duty to inform you that the master is dead.
Dead? I don't believe it.
Aye, my lord, dead he is. Dead in the wilderness. I myself buried him.
Where? What did he pretend to die of?
Why, he just seemed to sicken me, Lord. Just passed away back there in the forest.
There it is. You see, Allison, he's not dead at all. He couldn't be.
But good heavens, master. The man's buried.
I won't believe it till I see it for myself. You hear me? Not till I see it for myself.
Deep in the wilderness, my poor, distressed husband came upon his brother's grave. None of us could stop him.
I won't believe it. I'll dig him up and see. I won't believe it. He's been dead before. I'll come back to torture us alive again. I won't believe it till I see.
Poor Jamie's body was torn out of its grave. A still night it was, and the moon not yet set. The corpse seemed almost.
He lives!
Oh, my dear, you're beside yourself.
I saw his eyes flutter. I saw him look at me. With those eyes of his, he looked at me. I knew it. He's outlived me.
I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live.
My Lord of Durrisdeer died in my arms. The two were taken back together to the city. The two brothers, faithful old MacKellar, free into everything.
With your permission, ma'am, I've penned this epitaph for them. Will you read it, please?
Here lies the body of James Durrisdeer, heir to a Scottish title, a master of the arts and graces, admired in Europe, Asia, America, in war and peace, in the tents of savage hunters, and the citadel of kings. After so much acquired, accomplished, and endured, lies here forgotten. Read out the rest to me.
Here also lies Henry Durrisdeer, his brother, after a life of unmerited distress, bravely supported, died almost in the same hour, and sleeps in the same grave with his fraternal enemy.
The piety of his wife and an old servant raised this stone to both.
Shenley's Cresta Blanca wine joins the audience here in Hollywood in applauding Agnes Moorhead, Ray Collins, and Alan Napier on tonight's play in This Is My Best. In a few moments, Mr. Wells will be back to tell you about next week. Now, Mr. Orson Welles.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Before I tell you about next week's show, here's an important announcement. This month, we're all being asked to contribute to the United National Clothing Collection Drive, so search your attics, trunks, closets, cellars, and other storage places for garments to send to the millions of men, women, and children in war-devastated areas. This is not a charity drive, but a patriotic appeal to help those whose need arises from the destruction brought on by the war. And now, just a word about the show next Tuesday. It's called Don't Catch Me. And it's a screwball comedy, if you ever heard one. The leading lady is, I think I can go right out on a limb and say that I think she's my favorite actress in all the world. After a great deal of trouble, we finally succeeded in getting her on this program. It is with no little pride that I give you her name. I hope I can pronounce it right, Miss Rita Hayworth. Please do join us next week and hear Rita and your obedient servant, and believe me, our obedient servant, in what I think you'll enjoy, a pretty cute show. Please be our guest until then. Until next Tuesday, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Our musical score was composed and conducted by Bernard Katz. Our story was adapted for radio by Robert Tallman. Agnes Moorhead appears through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and may soon be seen in the newly released picture, Keep Your Powder Dry. Don't forget, next week, Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth will star in a radio adaptation of Don't Catch Me by Richard Powell. And remember, whenever you dine, dine with wine and make it the best wine. C-R-E-S-T-A? D-L-A-N-C-A. Cresta Blanca. Cresta Blanca. This is My Best, prepared in collaboration with Whit Burnett, editor of the book This Is My Best, is a presentation of the Cresta Blanca Wine Company of Livermore, California, and came to you from Columbia's Playhouse in Hollywood. Vern Smith speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This Is My Best on Tuned to Yesterday from April 10th, 1945 on CBS, adapting the Robert Louis Stevenson story, The Master of Ballantrae, first published in 1889. You're listening to an hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levionier. And now the CBS Radio Workshop adapts stories much older than the one we just heard. It's the No Plays of Japan as an NOH. Enjoy an adaptation of a 14th century drama starring Virginia Gregg, John Daner, and William Conrad as narrator from April 7th, 1957 on CBS.
CBS Radio presents the CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Today, the workshop offers an unusual departure in radio drama, a free adaptation of 14th century Japanese theater based on Arthur Whaley's translations of the classic No Plays of Japan, adapted by Harvey Marlowe. Music composed and conducted by the noted Japanese composer Takshindo.
There is a rock which stands at the gates of the shrine on the highest peak of Mount Katsuragi. On this rock is written, "Whosoever of all mortal men, whether he be king or slave, if he turn his heart to me, I will send a light to lead him and guide him on his way."
I am Lord Hojo no Tokiyori, ruler of all Japan. But today my heart is heavy. The prayers at the temple are of no avail against the illness that has overtaken my wife, mother to the heir to my throne. Perhaps a pilgrimage to Mount Katsuragi will serve her better than all these prayers here at the temple.
So he arranged with the temple priests for a pilgrimage to begin on the morrow. Clad in the holy habit of the priests, with only his honored short sword strapped to his side, he went to take leave of his wife.
I have come to say goodbye, for I am soon starting on a ritual mountain climbing.
God be with you. I have heard that it is a dangerous ritual. Shall you take our son with you?
It is not a journey that a young child could make.
Well, I pray you will come back safely.
And I will pray for your good health. I must go now.
My lord, I have something to say.
What is it?
I would go with you to the mountains.
No. No, how could you leave your mother when she is not well?
It is because my mother is ill that I would go with you to pray for her.
My dear wife, your son says he would come with us. What is to be done?
Ishiwakamaru, when your father leaves, I will have none but you at my side. I have not had you out of mind or sight for as long a time as it takes a dewdrop to dry. Give me back the measure of my love. Let your love keep you with me.
This is all as you say, yet nothing shall move me from my purpose. I must climb this difficult path and pray for your health in this life.
They saw no plea could move him, and so they set out. 40 or more, priests, pilgrims, the ruler of all Japan, and his son. The way was rough and torturous, the elements showing no respect for the pilgrims nor the ruler of all Japan. For the winds howled and the thunder rolled down from the mountains. The rain and the sleet wetted them so that they were all ashiver. And in the hail, the size of hen's eggs smote them, and they all cowered in the shelter of the rocks. And Lord Hojo no Tokiyori, noticing his son faltering more than the rest, ordered the pilgrims to halt and take shelter.
We have climbed so fast, we are already near the summit. We will stay here and rest for a while.
My lord, we gladly obey.
Father, I have something to say.
What is it, my son?
I do not feel well.
Quiet, my son. Let not the priests hear you talk so. Lest the spirits of the mountain take offense at our coming. Perhaps you are merely tired because you are not used to climbing. Lie there. Rest.
But the boy was not merely tired from climbing. He was deathly ill. And soon the color ebbed from his face. His complexion was as the coloration of the rocks around him. The priests and the pilgrims grew restless, and as they grew restless, they grew fearful. They muttered amongst themselves, and they commissioned the priest to speak strongly to Lord Hojo no Tokiyori.
The pilgrims are saying that your son is indisposed.
He is not feeling well, but there is nothing wrong with him. He's only tired with climbing.
So you are not troubled about him?
No. He will arise refreshed and ready to resume the climb in the morning.
But the pilgrims would not readily accept this reassurance. All night they burnt incense and chanted the scriptures. In the morning, they gathered around the child, and they saw that he was no better. Again they grew restless, and then fearful, and they muttered among themselves, and again they commissioned the priest to speak with Lord Hojo no Tokiyori.
Oh, master, ruler of all Japan, last night you said this boy was only tired from climbing, but now he is looking very strange.
Though I say it with dread, there has been from ancient times a custom that those who fail in this climb should be cast down. All the pilgrims are saying that he should be thrown into the valley.
Would you hurl this innocent child into the valley?
It is the custom of the god of Kumano.
It is a mighty custom. I cannot gainsay it.
Then the pilgrims, sighing for the sad ways of the world and the bitter ordinances of it, made ready for the hurling. Foot to foot they stood together. And Tokiyori, too, amongst them. Heaving blindly, none guiltier than his neighbor. The piercing cry of the falling boy emblazoned deep in the mind of Tokiyori, echoed again and again from mountaintop to mountaintop, from pilgrim heart to pilgrim heart. Like a madman, he stood there and had to be restrained lest he leap after the falling boy. And the winds howled and the thunder rolled down from the mountaintops. With anguished face raised high to the gods above, he vowed to forsake all worldly goods and to dedicate himself to eternal earthly wanderings until his flesh became spirit and merged with the like of his son. He unbuckled his honored short sword and flung it far into the valley to rest forever beside his son. And then, as a lowly priest, he set out on his lonely wanderings, and would brook no one addressing him as Lord Tokiyori. And soon no one any longer knew him as Lord Tokiyori, ruler of all Japan. 4 years pass, 4 years of wandering, 4 years of not forgetting. 4 years later, he again found himself in the valley at the foot of Mount Katsuragi.
Hara, it is snowing again. I must seek shelter here.
The curtain of snow parted, and there, not many feet from where he stood, lay a windswept excuse for a house. He knocked and called.
Is there anyone in this house?
Who is there?
I am a pilgrim. Pray let me lodge here for the night.
That is a small thing to ask, but we have no lodging fit for you. We cannot receive...
No, no. I do not care how poor the lodging may be. Pray, let me stay for this one night.
We would gladly ask you to stay, but there is scarcely space for us that are husband and wife and a boy whom I call son. You had best be on your way before the daylight goes.
So you are resolved to turn me away?
I am sorry for it, but we cannot shelter you.
Peace be with you. I will go my way.
Alas, it is because in a former life we neglected the ordinances that we are now come to ruin. Please let him stay.
If you are of that mind, why did you not speak before? Holy man, we will give you lodging. Though mean the shelter, rest with us till day.
Gladly he took shelter with them and shared with them their food. But alas, he also shared with them the cold, for it was no warmer in the hut than without. And the cold wind from the woods blows sleep away and the dreams of recollection. And on the morrow, with the gray of dawn, as he had made ready to take his leave, he said,
"There is something I must ask. I would gladly know to what clan my host belongs."
"Indeed, I have no reason to conceal it. Know then that Tsuneyo Gendaimon, Lord of Sarno, has sunk to this."
"How came it, sir, that you fell to such misery?"
"And thus it was. Kinsmen usurped my lands, and so I became what I am."
"Why do you not go up to the capital and lay your case before the Shiken's court?"
"By further mischance, it happens that Lord Hojo no Tokiyori himself is absent upon pilgrimage, lo, these past 4 years. And yet, all is not lost. For on the wall, a tall spear still hangs, and armor with it, while in a stall a steed is tied. And if at any time there came word from the city, news of peril to our master, then, broken though it be, I would gird this armor on, and rusty though it be, I would hold tall this spear, and lean ribbed though he be, I would mount my horse and ride neck by neck with the swiftest. But alas, another fate awaits me, worn with hunger, to die useless."
"Take courage. You shall not end so. If I live, I will come to you again. Now I must go."
"Then take this boy I call my son to guide and protect you on your way."
"Yes. I am strangely drawn to him. He is like my own son had he lived. You have good cause to be proud of him."
"As much as if he were of my own flesh. 4 years ago, we found him wandering in the valley, neither he nor we knowing whence he came from nor how. Strapped to his side was this honored sword."
And then Tokiyori knew that his pilgrimage was over, and he embraced the boy. But he did not reveal himself, but merely said he would be glad to have him as guide and protector. And he turned to Tsuneyo and his wife.
"Though my longing bides with you..."
"You leave us?"
"Farewell. You have made me happier than you know."
"Come back to us soon."
He said no more. He went his way. He sad to leave them, and they to lose them from their sight. They traveled many roads together, prayed at many temples, and read the scriptures together. And a bond grew between them, such as father and son. But still he did not reveal himself. Daily he versed him in the science of state, in the expression of poetry, in the arts of battle. He taught him the overhead slash, the ten-side cut, the eight-side sweep, the body wheel, the hanyu turn, the flower double, the blade drop, the maple leaf double, and the gnashing lion. He taught him to be nimble on his feet, but never to retreat. And then the winds abated. The snows melted and the rains came. And soon the cherry trees were in full blossom. They had traveled hard and they traveled fast. And then, weary with travel, they came to the inn of Akasaka in the country of Mino.
"Welcome, O holy priest. You grace my house with your presence. And you too, noble young prince."
"We thank you for your hospitality. But I am no prince."
"Oh?
Merely a pilgrim in company of this holy priest."
"Oh, be that as it may, you're doubly welcome. While my good wife prepares some hot food for your stomach, Do come and meet my other lodgers and listen to the sweet voice of Tonoi. She's renowned through all of Mino. Pleased to meet Kichiji and Kichiroku, merchants of Mino. I'm sure they will pleasure your presence on the journey tomorrow.
You are many times welcome, for this area is infested with robber bands who prey on merchants such as us.
We cannot hope to outnumber them, but perhaps they will not impede our journey if we travel together with a holy man and so stalwart a young protector.
We join you gladly. This sword that serves this holy man shall serve you as well.
Then join with us in some food and wine.
It seems the geisha girl would approach us. Come closer, girl. What would you say?
I have words of warning for you.
Then speak without fear. We listen readily.
Be on your guard, gentlemen, for the outlaw Kumasuke has got wind of your coming and the gold you carry and has sworn to set his brigands upon you tonight.
All is now lost. What are we to do?
How can we defend ourselves against the hordes of Kumasaka?
Let them come in what force they will. Yet if one stout soldier go out to meet them, they will not stand their ground, though they be 50 armed men.
What can one mere stripling do against so many?
Perhaps we can trade them our gold for our lives?
Nay, you shall walk over many dead bodies ere you have to give up your gold or your lives. Holy man, give me your blessing ere I go.
Go, my son. Go with God. And remember well the lessons I have taught you. And know this too, ere you go. 4 years ago, my son was lost to me. But the gods were kind. I found him again in Tsuneo's house.
The boy embraced his father and then turned to the others.
Now arm yourselves as best you can and wait here. I will go out to meet them.
And while he spoke, evening passed to darkness. He found himself a place where only three or four could pass abreast and waited. The night was still. No sound but the crickets and the quick breathing of the boy. The moon was bright and cast many fearsome shadows around him. But neither evil spirits nor evil men could chill the heart of little Ushiwakamaru, son of Lord Hojono Tokiori, ruler of all Japan. And then, a wave of sound, of horses and men roared over the hill. In they rushed, each jostling to be first to cut down the stripling. More of them and more in a wild onslaught. Not even the god of peril had dared to face them, but little Ushiwakamaru showed no fear. He drew his belt sword and met them. The lion pounced, the tiger leaped, the bird pounced. He parried them all. The body wheel, the hanyu turn, the flower double. But they could not prevail. 30 there were who attacked him. Now 13 lay there who were dead. And others, wounded, flung down their swords and slunk back weaponless to report to Kumasaka. And then Kumasaka cried,
"What demon of God can he be under whose hand all these are fallen? For a man he cannot be. Shall Kumasaki Chohan be worsted in tonight's affray? Where could he then hide his shame? If he be but spirit covered with flesh, I will cut him asunder or die with my men. Come, robbers, to the attack!"
So with mighty voice he called them to him, and they, raising their war cry, leapt to renew the assault. Fast as the wind they rode, none daring to overtake the mighty Kumasaka, lest they be the first to meet the lightning thrust of Ushiwakamaru's blade. And suddenly, there he stood, waiting. So tiny he appeared against the tall mound of slain bodies. Yet so unperturbed he seemed, Kumasaka's heart was chilled with the sight. But he measured by eye Ushiwakamaru's 2-foot blade against his 5.5-foot sword. And he thought, be he mortal or hobgoblin, demon or god, tonight's battle will be fought in hell. and he forced wild laughter from his throat to ward off the chill in his heart and perchance to frighten the boy. But none of his men joined him. All stood silently by. Slowly they merged in the circle of battle, each waiting for the other to spring. Warily they circled. Cautiously they moved. And so they fought. Now closing, now breaking. Again and again Kumasaka strikes. Again and again his blows are parried. And then Kumasaka, deeply versed in the art of the battle sword, lunged for his left foot, and in quick succession he executed the ten-side cut, the eight-side sweep, the body wheel, the hanyu turn, the flower double, and Ushiwakamaru countered with the blade drop, the gnashing line, the maple leaf double, and the bird parts. Thus a thousand parts they fought, neither wearied, ever strong. And then Kumasaka, losing patience, threw down his battle sword and, spreading out his great hands, rushed wildly forward. But Ushiwakamaru dodged him as he passed, mowed around at his legs. Kumasaka fell with a crash. And as he struggled to rise, the belt sword of Ushiwakamaru smote him clean through the waist. And Kumasaka, that had been one man, lay cloven in twain. Then Ushiwakamaru, mounting Kumasaka's steed, made his way back to the inn. Lord Hojo no Tokiyori, overjoyed at the safe return of his son and his miraculous accomplishments, had this to say.
Now that I have a son to share my throne with honor and serve my people with integrity, I would return to my wife and to the affairs of state. When the pale moon fades from this night's sky, we will pursue our way toward the capital.
That very morning they set out on their way and reached the capital without further mishap. And there was great celebrating and rejoicing awaiting them. There were fireworks and cannon, parades, entertainments and pageantry, feasting and much spilling of wine. The temple bells tolled for the safe return of the ruler and the young prince. And heeding their call, the ruler, his wife, and the young prince forsook the revelries of the populace and spent 2 days fasting and praying to the great god of Kama. And when they returned from their meditations, he issued a proclamation.
This public notice is hereby posted. If there be those amongst you who would challenge my return to rule this land of sunrise, then mass your armies and declare your aims. Or if you be of a mind to serve your ruler loyally and true, then come in full regalia and receive my blessing and my love.
They came from far and near, barons and dukes, lords and masters, chamberlains and chancellors, samurai and soldiers, pilgrims and priests, farmers and merchants, fishermen and sailors, free men and slaves. They came on horses fat with fodder, on rickshaws rickety and worn, in carriages resplendent, in clothes raggedy and torn. And along with them rides Suneo, haggard and wan. The horse is old, it cannot hasten, neither whip nor spur can urge it on. His armor is dented, worn and dusty, his spear is tall, corroded and rusty, but he moves like a man dedicated to serve his ruler, his country, with determination and nerve. Many a road was traveled, many a day had set to rest until all were assembled in the great courtyard of the palace, and the ruler called to his attendant.
Have the samurai, the lords, and nobles all arrived?
Yes, my lord, they have all come.
Among them should be a knight in broken armor, carrying a rusty sword and leading his own lean horse. Find him and bring him to me.
I tremble and obey, your majesty.
He ran without catching his breath, and amongst the richly clad nobles, he had no trouble finding Suneo. He was led to where on a great dais all the warriors of this levy were assembled like a bright bevy of stars. Row on row they were ranged, samurai and soldiers, nobles and lords, bejeweled and resplendent. Swift, scornful glances, fingers pointed, and the noise of laughter met his entering. His rusty sword sags and trails, yet undaunted he kneels at the foot of the throne where sits Tokiyori and the young prince.
Silence!
My lord, I have come.
He has come indeed. Tsuneo, lord of Sano, Have you forgotten the priest whom once you sheltered from the snowstorm, and the boy you once called son?
My lord, I am overwhelmed.
You have been true to the words that you spoke. Now I shall be true to mine. Now all ye hear this. In the case of Tsuneo, I return to him his land, his title, and his deeds, and add to this my eternal gratitude and devotion.
Then Tsuneo took his bow before the ruler of all Japan, embraced the young prince, the one he once called son, and then, broken though it was, he girded his armor on, and rusty though it was, he held straight his spear, and bony though it was, he mounted his steed and went proudly his homeward way.
You have been listening to a free adaptation of early Japanese theater written by Harvey Marlowe. Featured in today's cast were William Conrad, John Daner, Hans Conried, Virginia Gregg, Mary Flynn, Ben Wright, Joe DeSantis, Torrin Thatcher, Henry Blair, David Frankham, and Yoshiko Niya. Authentic court music by the Tenrikyo Kyokai Musicians, choral group from the Japanese Union Church of Los Angeles. Original music composed and conducted by Chuck Shindo. CBS Radio Workshop was produced and directed by Harvey Marlowe.
This is the CBS Radio Network.
The CBS Radio Workshop on Tuned to Yesterday from April 7th, 1957 on CBS. And the curtain comes down on this hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.